Welcome back to the deep dive. Today, I think we need to, well, I need to ask you to take a deep breath.
Definitely a good idea.
Seriously, take a deep breath because we are not just going off the deep end today. We are diving straight into the Mariana Trench of metaphysical literature. We are tackling what is, without a doubt, the most dense, internally consistent, and intellectually demanding body of channeled material I think ever produced.
It really is the Mount Everest of channeling. We are, of course, talking about the Law of One, which is also known as the raw material.
Right. And before anyone out there rolls their eyes and says, oh, great, another story about Little Green Man, we really need to set the record straight right from the jump. This isn't a story about a flying saucer landing on the White House lawn.
No, not at all.
This is a massive collection of transcripts. We're talking over 100 recorded sessions from 1981 to 1984.
Yeah.
It's thousands of questions and answers that essentially map out, well, they map out everything.
Yeah, and saying everything is barely an exaggeration here. I mean, it covers the creation of the universe, the evolution of consciousness, the physics of light, the deep history of our solar system, and this is the big one, the specific spiritual purpose of your life right now.
It's basically a unified field theory for the human soul.
That is a perfect way to put it.
The premise, I mean, it sounds like absolute science fiction. We have telepathic contact with a group mind from the sixth dimension. We have pyramids built entirely by thought. We have galactic history involving exploding planets and genetic engineering.
Right, it sounds wild.
It does. But here's the kicker, and this is exactly why we're doing this deep dive today. It holds together.
That is the most striking thing about it, honestly. Most channeled material, and I've read a lot of it over the years, tends to be very vague. It's a lot of, love and light fluff, just good vibes.
Yeah, exactly.
But the raw material is rigorous. It has a highly specific vocabulary. It aligns with some very obscure physics theories, and the philosophical architecture of it is just staggering in its complexity.
So our mission today is to distill this massive stack of dry, incredibly dense books into a map that you can actually use. We're going to look at the nature of reality, try to figure out why we're all here, and discuss this thing called the choice that rests as every single one of us has to make.
But first, we really have to meet the team, because this wasn't just one random person sitting in a room hearing voices.
Right. It was set up as a scientific experiment. The group was called LL Research.
Exactly. And you had three key players. First, you have Don Elkins. He was the driving force behind the whole thing. He was a former physics professor, an airline pilot, and a mechanical engineer.
Very analytical background.
Highly analytical. He was the questioner. He approached this entire phenomenon with a scientist's mind, constantly looking for verifiable data.
Then you have Carla Ruckert.
Right, the instrument. Now, Carla was a devout Christian, actually, with a very pure, almost mystical approach to spirituality. She was the one who went into the deep trance state to allow the contact to happen.
And finally, rounding out the trio, Jim McCarty.
The scribe. Jim was kind of the survivalist, the builder, the grounding force of the group. He made sure the tape recorders were running, he transcribed the sessions, and he kept the group functioning on a practical day-to-day level.
So let's set the scene for us. It's January 15th, 1981. They're in Kentucky.
Yeah.
What actually happens?
Well, they had been experimenting with meditation and channeling for quite a few years at that point. But on this specific day, during a fairly routine meditation session, the quality of the contact shifted dramatically.
Like a sudden upgrade.
Exactly. Carla went deeper into a trance than she ever had before. And an entity spoke through her, introducing itself with a very specific, very direct phrase. It just said, "I am Ra."
I am Ra. Short, punchy, definitely iconic. But who or what is Ra? Because from reading the source material, they definitely aren't claiming to be the Egyptian sun god in the mythological way we usually think of it.
Not exactly, no. They define themselves as a social memory complex.
Okay, let's unpack that term immediately because it comes up a lot in the books. Social memory complex, it honestly sounds like a bureaucratic government agency.
It really does. But think of it as the ultimate evolution of the internet, but specifically for consciousness. Ra explains that they come from the sixth density. At that level of spiritual evolution, individuals have essentially ceased to be separate.
And merge.
Right, they have total instantaneous access to the thoughts, the memories, and the experiences of every other being in their entire group.
So it's a hive mind, like the Borg in Star Trek.
That's always the common fear when people hear this, but no, the Borg are all about forced assimilation and the complete loss of self. Ra describes a social memory complex as a completely voluntary union.
A choice.
Exactly. Imagine a choir. Every singer has their own unique voice, their own tone, but they are singing the exact same chord perfectly together. The I becomes we, not because you lost yourself, but because you sort of found everyone else.
That's a beautiful way to frame it. And they claim they've actually been to Earth before, right? Long before 1981.
Yes. And this is where the Egyptian connection comes in. Ra claims they visited Earth during the 18th dynasty, specifically to speak with the pharaoh Akhenaten.
Oh, the heretic king. The guy who suddenly tried to switch all of ancient Egypt over to monotheism?
That's the one. Ra says they appeared to him directly to teach the law of one, to teach the idea that all gods are actually one god, that all things are unity. And Akhenaten got it. He really understood the message.
But I'm guessing the priests and the power structure around him didn't.
Not so much. They completely distorted the message. The priest took this beautiful idea of the one and immediately turned it into a tool for political power. They basically said, I am the representative of the one, so you must obey me.
It became elitist.
Exactly. It became a way to control the masses. And Ra explicitly states in the transcripts that they left because they felt hypocritical.
Hypocritical how?
They realized that by appearing in these glowing magical bodies or landing ships, they were being worshipped as gods. And being worshipped creates separation. It creates a hierarchy, which is the exact opposite of the unity they were trying to teach.
So they essentially just ghosted this.
In a manner of speaking, yeah. They retreated to the invisible realms. They decided to try and help from a distance. Just wait until this little group in Kentucky in 1981 developed the exact right vibration to call them back.
All right, let's get into the meat of it, the actual philosophy. If we had to boil thousands of pages down to a bumper sticker, it's literally the title of the book, The Law of One. But what does that actually mean in a practical sense?
It is the primary axiom of their entire universe. Ra states it very simply, all things are one. That means there is no fundamental difference between you, me, the microphone in front of us, the listener at home, and the star Alpha Centauri.
It's all the same stuff.
Exactly. There is no right or wrong. There is no polarity. There is only identity. Everything, absolutely everything, is the one infinite creator.
Which sounds beautiful, very poetic even. But I have to play devil's advocate here for a second. I look at the news. I see war. I see suffering. I see people cutting each other off in traffic. It sure doesn't look like we are all one. It feels like we are very, very separate.
And that feeling is what Ra calls the original paradox. They explain that the one infinite creator, which they refer to as intelligent infinity, essentially got lonely. It became aware of itself.
How do you mean?
Well, to truly know itself, it had to experience itself. If you're everything, you can't interact with anything. So it focused its intent, its energy, into what Ra calls intelligent energy.
Ra also calls this focused intent the logos, right? Or simply love.
Correct. And from that primary focus, the creator began to build the illusion of separation. Ra calls these steps of creation distortions. Now, in everyday English, distortion sounds bad, like a broken speaker or a warped mirror.
Right, like something went wrong.
But Ra uses the word distortion to simply mean a modification from the original pure unity.
Okay, so what are the big distortions? How do we get from one infinite soup to me paying taxes?
Right. The first distortion is the absolute game changer. It's free will. Ra actually calls it the law of confusion.
The law of confusion? That's a bit on the nose, isn't it?
It's very literal. The creator grants every single part of itself, meaning us, total freedom. But for that freedom to be real, for your choices to matter, you cannot know the answers. Because if you knew with 100% certainty that you were the creator, you would never act out. You'd never make a mistake. You'd just be static. So the confusion is baked into the system to allow for genuine, unscripted choice.
So we are blindfolded completely on purpose.
Yes, we have to be. Then the second distortion is love, which is the creative principle itself. And the third distortion is light. Ra goes into some very heavy physics here, but essentially light is the primary building block. Matter, as we know it, is just light that has been vibrated into a specific slower frequency.
So let me synthesize this. Everything we touch, everything we see, is condensed light, driven by the force of love, operating under the rule of free will, all to allow the creator to basically learn about itself through our experiences.
That is the map. You nailed it.
But this intense feeling of separation? Ra has a very specific term for why we feel it so strongly here on Earth. They call it the veil of forgetting.
The veil is the core mechanism that makes human life, what they call third density, so difficult, but also so incredibly valuable. In other higher densities, the truth is pretty obvious. You can clearly see the energetic connection between things.
But here?
Here, a thick curtain is drawn across the mind. You are born with total amnesia, You don't remember your past lives, you don't remember the spiritual realms, and you certainly don't remember that you are the creator.
Why, though? It just seems so cruel. Why toss us into a maze without a map and turn the lights off?
To see what you do in the dark, Ra uses a brilliant analogy. Think of a poker game. If you played poker with all your cards face up on the table, there's no tension, there's no strategy, no character reveal.
It's just a math equation at that point.
Exactly. The veil forces you to act on faith and intuition. It gives immense weight to your choices. Because if you choose to be kind to someone, even when you truly believe you are completely separate from them and you get no reward for it, that kindness is incredibly powerful. It literally changes the creator's understanding of itself.
That transitions us perfectly into the actual structure of the universe as Rael lays it out. They don't just say there's heaven and earth. They break evolution down into seven distinct stages, which they call densities.
And this is where the internal consistency of the material is just remarkable. Ray describes an octave of experience, just like a musical scale or the color spectrum. Consciousness moves upward from red to violet.
Let's walk through the scale. I really want to give you, the listener, a sense of where you've been and where you're going according to this map. Let's start at the absolute bottom. Red ray, first density.
First density is the cycle of simple awareness. This is the elements: fire, wind, water, earth. It's the foundational building blocks. Think of billions of years of cooling rock and swirling oceans. The spiritual lesson here is simply beingness.
Okay, just existing. Then life starts to emerge. Second density, orange ray.
The cycle of growth and movement. This is plants, bacteria, and eventually all the animals. The key shift here is the beginning of interaction. A tree turning toward the sun. A wolf pack learning to work together to hunt. It's the beginning of a self interacting with another.
And Rob mentioned something fascinating about pets here, right? Our domestic animals.
Yes, this is a beautiful detail. They say that the highest forms of second density, like our dogs and cats, can actually be individuated by the love of a human.
Meaning what exactly?
By giving them a name, by loving them and treating them as individuals, we actively pull their consciousness up towards self-awareness. We act as a literal bridge for them to graduate out of a flock or herd mentality and into an individual soul.
That perfectly explains why my dog genuinely thinks he's people. He's practicing. Okay, so then we hit the big one. Third density, yellow ray. This is us right now.
This is the cycle of self-awareness. And it is the only density in the entire octave where the veil of forgetting exists. Ray emphasizes that this density is actually very short compared to all the others. It's only a 75,000-year cycle, but it is incredibly intense. It is the choice density.
We're going to spend a whole section on the choice in just a minute because that's the real crux of the biscuit here. But let's finish the ladder first. What happens after us? Fourth density, green ray.
This is what Earth is supposedly evolving into right now, the cycle of love and understanding. In fourth density, that heavy veil of amnesia is finally lifted. And the most significant practical change is that telepathy becomes the standard mode of communication.
Which means absolutely no more secrets.
No more lies. You cannot manipulate or deceive someone if they can instantly see your true intentions. Because of this transparency, fourth density is a place of immense compassion. It's where those social memory complexes we talked about begin to form.
Then we move to fifth density, Blu-ray.
The cycle of light and wisdom. This is an interesting critique from Ra. They say that fourth density entities have a massive amount of love, but they can actually be a bit naive or foolish.
Coolish how?
They want to save everyone. They will martyr themselves constantly, even if stepping in and saving someone robs that person of a necessary lesson.
Ah, I see.
So, fifth density is where you step back and learn the wisdom to apply that love correctly. It's a density of intense intellectual power, deep individualism, and mastering the manipulation of light.
Then sixth density, Indigo Ray.
The cycle of unity. This is Ra's current home address. In sixth density, you perfectly balance the love of the fourth and the wisdom of the fifth. You blend them into a unified, functioning whole. This is where the individual truly fully merges into the group mind while retaining their unique flavor.
And seventh density, Violet Ray.
The gateway. This is the final stage. Here, you are just preparing to merge entirely back into the octave, back into the creator. It's a formless, timeless state before the great mystery of the eighth density begins the whole musical scale over again, just on a completely new, higher level that Ra admits they don't even fully understand yet.
I want to pause on the science part of this for a second, because Ra talks about these densities not just as metaphorical spiritual levels, but as literal physics. Don Elkins, being the questioner, was absolutely obsessed with the physics of this. He brought up a guy named Dewey B. Larson.
Right, this is a deep cut, but it's crucial for understanding the logic of the source material. Dewey Larson was an actual real-world physicist who proposed a fringe theory called reciprocal system theory.
And what's the gist of that?
The basic idea is that the universe isn't fundamentally made of matter, it's made of motion, specifically motion in time and space. Time and space are reciprocals of each other.
And Ra basically confirmed this.
They did. Rad told Don that Larson's theory was the closest thing our modern science had to the actual truth. They explained that each of these densities we just listed corresponds to a distinctly different vibratory rate of the quantum field. First density is a very slow, dense vibration. Third is faster. Fourth is faster still.
So when New Age circles talk about ascending or raising your vibration, they don't mean flying up into the sky in a cloud. They mean literally speeding up the rotation of your quantum particles.
In a very real sense, yes, it's metaphysical biology. Ra describes the human body as containing a series of energy centers, what Eastern traditions call chakras, that act essentially like transformers for this energy.
Like electrical transformers.
Exactly. As you learn spiritual lessons in your daily life, you are literally unclogging these energy centers from red up through violet, allowing more of that intelligent energy to flow through you. If your internal vibration speeds up enough, you naturally shift into the next density. It's not a moral judgment from a guy on a throne. It's pure mechanics. It's like tuning a radio. If you're broadcasting on FM 104, you simply cannot be heard on AM 600.
Okay, so how do we tune the radio? Because Ra is very, very specific about the singular purpose of our life here in third density. They say we are here to make the choice.
This is the beating heart of the entire raw material. To progress from third density up to fourth, consciousness must polarize. You cannot stay lukewarm. You cannot just float in the comfortable middle forever. You have to pick a direction.
You have to choose a team. And those teams are defined as service to others and service to self.
Correct. The positive path is service to others. This is the path of acceptance, radiating love, seeking unity, and attempting to help. It's built on the realization that the other person actually is you.
And the negative path, service to self.
This is the path of absolute control, manipulation, and separation. The service to self entity also fundamentally seeks the creator, but they do it by attempting to condense all power into themselves. They view the universe as a strict hierarchy where they must climb to the top and subjugate everything below them.
Now, here is where it gets really interesting and honestly a bit controversial. The requirements to actually graduate from this density. Rog gives us the exact math, and the math is kind of shocking.
It really is. To be harvestable to fourth density, positive meaning to graduate onto the good team, Ra states an entity must be 51% service to others.
51%? I mean, that is barely a majority.
It's just over half. And it implies something very profound. You don't have to be a saint. You don't have to be a perfect ascetic monk or Mother Teresa. You just have to tip the scales. You have to be slightly more concerned with the welfare of others than you are with yourself, just more often than not.
That feels incredibly doable. Forgiving almost.
Yeah.
But then you look at the negative path. What's the cutoff there?
To be harvestable to fourth density negative, an entity must be 95% service to self.
95%. That is a massive gap. Why is it so much harder to be a successful bad guy in this universe?
Think about the physics we just discussed. The universe is entirely built on the law of one, pure unity. The natural default flow of cosmic energy is towards connection and love. The negative path is fighting that fundamental flow.
Like swimming upstream.
Exactly. It requires immense constant discipline and intense focus to block out the heart energy, to block out all compassion, and to force yourself to see everyone else solely as tools for your own advancement.
So a 95% negative entity is essentially functioning like a spiritual black hole.
That's a great metaphor. They are constantly absorbing light, never radiating it. To maintain that level of absorption without just collapsing under the pressure takes incredible force of will. That's why Rad actually respects the negative path in a strange way.
Wait, they respect them.
Yes, they call them the loyal opposition. They respect the sheer dedication and willpower it takes to achieve that polarization. Even though they completely disagree with the direction, they recognize they are playing a necessary role in the creator knowing itself.
Let's be real. Most people aren't 51% positive, and they definitely aren't 95% negative. Most people are just people. They're generally nice to their friends, but they cut strangers off in traffic. They love their kids, but maybe they cheat on their taxes. Where do they go when the cycle ends?
That is what Ra calls the sinkhole of indifference.
Ouch. That is a brutal term.
It is highly descriptive, though. If you haven't polarized enough in either direction, you are lukewarm. You literally do not have the internal electrical capacity, the intensity, to hold the higher light of fourth density. So what happens? You don't go to hell. There's no punishment. You simply repeat the grade.
You just get held back a year.
Right. But in this case, you reincarnate on a completely different third density planet to continue the cycle all over again until you finally make a definitive choice.
A very long year.
Yeah.
75,000 years, to be exact. Now, you mentioned the loyal opposition. This brings us to the actual cosmic scale of this conflict. The source material spends a lot of time talking about the Orion group.
The Orion group is the primary representative of the negative path in our local galaxy. Rod describes them as a fifth-density negative social memory complex.
Wait, a negative group mind? How does that even work? I thought negative entities wanted to be the boss of everything. How do they share a mind without killing each other?
That's exactly the weak point of the negative path. Ra explains that negative social memory complexes are not based on telepathic harmony. They are based on a rigorous, ruthless hierarchy. The entity at the absolute top controls the ones below them through fear, who then control the ones below them, and so on.
A giant pyramid scheme of power.
Precisely. It's not a union of love, it's an alliance of utility. They stick together simply because it makes them more effective at conquering others.
And what do they want with us? What do they want with Earth?
Total conquest. But not by landing armadas of ships and shooting lasers at cities, at least not usually. Because of the rules of free will, they want to enslave us by our own choice.
How do you trick an entire planet into choosing enslavement?
By offering them power. The Orion group telepathically contacts individuals on Earth who are already seeking control. Dictators, financial elites, people who are hungry for dominance. They offer them advanced philosophy, technology, or information that helps them consolidate that power over the masses.
So they arm the worst among us.
Right. The goal is to gradually create a planetary social structure that is 95% service to self, so the entire planet naturally falls into their negative empire when the harvest comes.
It's a slow motion spiritual
Exactly. And they also use targeted psychic attacks to disrupt positive groups who are trying to share messages of unity. We'll talk about how that specifically affected Ra's channelers a bit later, because it's a major part of the story, but it's a constant unseen pressure.
Before we get to the modern day, we really need to do a history lesson.
Mm.
Because Ra drops some absolute bombshells about where human beings actually come from. And spoiler alert for the listener, we are not all originally from here.
No, we are a massive cosmic melting pot. Ra describes Earth as an amalgamation of souls from various different sources. Mm-hmm. And the history of how they got here is, well, it's pretty tragic. It goes a long way to explaining why human psychology is so fractured and contradictory.
Let's start with Maldek.
Maldek was a physical planet right here in our solar system, located exactly where the asteroid belt is today. Right, was. Ra explains that the civilization on Maldek was highly technologically advanced, but spiritually very aggressive. They hadn't polarized toward love. Ultimately, they chose war. They developed and used weaponry that literally destabilized the planetary core. They blew their own planet into pieces.
Hence the asteroid belt.
Yes. Now, imagine the sheer trauma of that event. Ra says the souls of that entire population were caught in what they call a knot of fear. They were so traumatized by the sudden, violent destruction of their home that they couldn't even reincarnate. They were just stuck in a collective nightmare for thousands and thousands of years.
But eventually, they were untangled and moved to Earth.
The Confederation, which is the alliance of positive, higher-density groups Ra belongs to, eventually managed to reach them and transfer their souls here to start over at the very bottom of third density. And Ra adds a detail here that is both totally bizarre and oddly poignant.
I know what you're going to say.
They say that some of these Maldek souls, due to their intense karmic need to learn humility and to completely lose access to the technology that destroyed them, actually chose to incarnate in highly robust second density animal bodies.
You're talking about Bigfoot.
I'm absolutely talking about Bigfoot. Ren explicitly answers a question from Dawn about the Sasquatch phenomenon. They state that these creatures are mostly Maldek souls, inhabiting bodies that are hardy and meant to live deep in nature, to slowly, over thousands of years, heal their trauma and learn to be gentle again without the temptation of tools.
So Bigfoot isn't a scary monster. He's a cosmic refugee dealing with severe planetary PTSD. That is, I mean, it's surprisingly touching.
It completely reframes the myth, doesn't it? It creates a huge sense of compassion. Then we have the second major group, Mars.
Mars also had a really bad run.
A very similar story, unfortunately. About 75,000 years ago, the civilization on Mars destroyed their own atmosphere through nuclear or at least highly bellicose means. They didn't completely shatter the planet like Maldek, but they made it completely uninhabitable.
And those souls had to come here too.
Yes. The Guardians transferred the Martian souls to Earth to continue their cycle. But there was a biological problem. Mars has significantly lower gravity in a different environment. The Martian energetic templates weren't suited for the primate bodies evolving on Earth. So Ross says the Guardians actually had to perform genetic modification to adapt these souls to Earth bodies.
So if you're listening to this and you constantly feel like you just don't belong here or the world feels too heavy, maybe you literally don't. I mean, look at the roster. We have the traumatized destroyers of Maldek, the bellicose refugees of Mars, all crammed onto one planet, just trying not to blow it up a third time.
That is exactly the volatile situation we are in. And then you add the native group, the souls graduating up from Earth's own second density apes. It's a very intense, difficult mix of energies.
And then, even after they got here, we had Atlantis.
Right. Atlantis was an attempt by the Confederation to help us get it right. It was a highly advanced civilization. They were given access to the Law of One. They understood the mechanics of intelligent energy. They used massive crystals for healing the body and for generating clean power.
I always think of crystals as just pretty rocks you buy at a New Age store, but Ra talks about them like they're literal nuclear reactors.
Because to them, they are. Ra describes crystals as highly organized structures that can be perfectly tuned. If you have a purified human healer, a crystal can channel the intelligent energy of the creator to heal the physical body almost instantly. But true to human nature, the Atlanteans eventually began to use this massive power for control.
Service to self rears its head again.
Exactly. The elites used the crystal technology to create weapons, to dominate other tribes, and to enslave people. Ra says this massive misuse of energy physically destabilized the Earth's crust again, the tie between consciousness and physics, and led to the literal sinking of the continent.
It's a dark pattern. We get smart, we get a little bit of power, we completely stop loving each other, and we blow everything up.
Which brings us perfectly to the concept of the quarantine.
Right. I wanted to ask about this. If the Confederation Rays Alliance is so incredibly powerful and benevolent, why don't they just land? Why don't they step in and stop us from nuking ourselves or destroying the climate?
Because of the first distortion, free will, it is the absolute highest law. They cannot infringe upon our right to choose. If they land a mothership on the White House lawn tomorrow, it would definitively prove they exist. It would instantly shatter the veil of forgetting. We would be forced to believe in them, and we'd probably just worship them. That totally robs us of the genuine line choice we are here to make.
So they're forced to just watch from the sidelines.
Mostly, yes. But because the Orion group was cheating, they were interfering too much and trying to enslave us, the Confederation set up a quarantine. It's an energetic net around Earth to block negative ships from landing openly and taking over. Ra says it's mostly effective, but windows in the net open up occasionally based on complex cosmic cycles. It's a leaky blockade.
There is a major loophole, though. A way for the good guys to actually get boots on the ground and help without breaking the free will rules. They call them wanderers.
This is one of the most resonant, popular concepts in the entire material. A wanderer is a soul from a higher density, someone who has already graduated to fourth, fifth, or sixth density, who voluntarily chooses to reincarnate as a human baby on Earth right now.
They actively sign up for the mission.
Yes, they leave their state of perfect unity, peace, and telepathic connection. They agree to put on that heavy veil of forgetting, and they are born into a physical body just like you and me, with no memory of who they really are.
Why do that? That seems like a terrible deal. You go from absolute cosmic paradise
Yeah.
to dealing with traffic jams and paying taxes and existential dread.
It is the ultimate act of service to others. They come here to act as anchors for the incoming light. Because they are fundamentally higher vibration beings, just by being here, just by living an ordinary life and vibrating at a higher frequency, they physically help stabilize the planet's energy grid during this difficult transition.
But there's a massive risk involved for them.
A huge risk. Since they forget who they are when they incarnate, they can get stuck. If they get too caught up in the drama and the karma of Earth, if they react to the world with constant anger or despair, they generate negative karma. They can literally lose their higher density status and get trapped in the third density cycle here.
Ra gives a specific list of symptoms for wanderers. And as we read these, I bet a lot of listeners are going to be checking these boxes mentally.
The most common symptom is a profound lifelong sense of alienation, a deep feeling of, I just don't belong here. This world doesn't make sense to me. Wanderers often have severe allergies. Their physical bodies literally reject the heavy, chaotic vibration of the earth environment. They usually strongly dislike authority and violence. And they have this nagging deep sense of a specific mission, but they usually can't remember what it is.
And Ross says there are millions of them here right now.
They estimated roughly 65 million were incarnate back at the time of the channeling in 1981. It's likely many, many more now. And they are here specifically for the event Ra calls the Harvest.
Let's talk about the Harvest, because honestly, the word sounds ominous. It sounds like an alien horror movie where we get put in pods.
It does sound creepy, but it's purely an agricultural metaphor. Ra says the 75,000-year cycle of our third density is officially ending. The physical planet Earth itself is currently moving into fourth density green ray. The base vibration of the planet is physically speeding up.
So the planet itself is upgrading its operating system.
Exactly. And the Harvest is simply the cosmic sorting process that happens at the end of the year. Those human souls who have polarized 51% positive will move with the Earth into the new fourth density reality, or they'll be relocated to another positive sphere to continue. Those who are 95% negative will be moved to a specific negative fourth density world to continue their dark path.
And the lukewarm ones.
They stay in third density, transported to a new planet to keep repeating the lessons.
And the craziest part is, Ra says this transition is happening right now.
Yes. They pinpointed the primary transition period as roughly between 1981 and 2011, though cosmic cycles obviously move very slowly and there's an overlap. But they explain that the intense friction we see in the world right now, the extreme social upheaval, the political polarization, the climate changes, the general anger, is actually a direct symptom of this energetic clash. The high-frequency green ray is bombarding the planet, and the people and systems that haven't polarized to love simply can't handle the voltage. It breaks them down.
So the sheer craziness of the modern world isn't necessarily a sign that everything is failing. It's actually a sign that the lights are finally turning on, and the old systems are short-circuiting.
That's a beautiful and very accurate way to look at it. It's the fever breaking before the healing.
I want to shift gears completely here to the stark reality of the channeling process itself. Because we can sit here and talk about this beautiful philosophy all day, but the human cost to the LL research team to get this information was incredibly high.
It was a literal battle. We mentioned psychic attacks by the Orion Group earlier. Well, the Orion Group absolutely did not want this book to be published.
And they went after the weak link, or rather the physical link, Carla.
Carla was the instrument. The channeling was extraordinarily physically draining for her. She was already somewhat frail, and she lost 2 to 3 pounds of body weight during every single session. Ra described the contact as a narrow band transmission. It required insanely precise tuning, or it could literally damage her nervous system.
They had specific rituals to protect her, right? The circle of one.
Yes, and it wasn't just spooky pageantry. They had to walk around her in a circle a specific number of times. They had to place specific charged items by her head. A Bible, a chalice of water, burning incense. Ray explained that these items acted as energetic focal points for the group's combined will. They helped lock the protective frequency around her body while her mind was out of it.
But the negative entities still found a way in.
They are relentlessly opportunistic. They constantly looked for any chink in the armor. If there was even slight disharmony or an argument between Dawn and Carla, or if Dawn was feeling intense self-doubt, the negative entity would slip in and amplify that weakness to attack Carla physically. There was the infamous kidney incident.
Tell us about that, because it shows how serious this was.
Carla had a long history of kidney issues. During a particularly intense period of the contact, the negative entity launched a concentrated psychic attack that drastically intensified her nephritis. It wasn't just a bad headache. She was pushed very close to total kidney failure. Ra warned the group that the attack was specifically designed to sever the instrument from her body, basically, to kill her, just to permanently stop the Ra transmission.
And then there's the tragedy of Dawn Elkins. This is the part of the story that really grounds it for me. It proves it's not just a feel-good love and light fantasy. It ended in actual death.
It did. Don was the intellectual engine of the whole project, but he carried a massive amount of internal doubt. He worried constantly about whether he was doing the right thing, whether he was asking the right questions, whether he was somehow leading Carla astray, and the negative entity latched onto that deep-seated anxiety.
And his mental state deteriorated.
Rapidly. By 1984, Don was suffering from severe, crippling paranoia. He believed the negative entities were actively controlling his mind and his reality. It became a terrible feedback loop. Jim and Carla tried desperately to help him, but he refused psychiatric medical intervention for a long time. Eventually, the psychic pressure, combined with his own internal distortions, just became too much to bear. On November 7th, 1984, Don Elkins took his own life.
That is just heartbreaking. After bringing all this light into the world, does Ra talk about this event?
They do, implicitly in the final sessions as things were deteriorating, and it's discussed heavily in the epilogues published by Jim and Carla later. And this is where the philosophy of the Law of One is really stress-tested. Ra does not judge Don. They don't have a concept of suicide as a sin that sends you to hell. They view it as a profound tragedy, yes, but also as a completely balanced part of the cosmic catalyst. Don gave his life, his energy, to bring this crucial information through the veil.
It reminds us that this isn't a parlor game. Dealing with high-level metaphysics, opening yourself up to these forces, it has real-world flesh-and-blood consequences.
Absolutely. Ra warns them repeatedly throughout the books. To know is to transform. Once you start pulling down this kind of high-voltage light, you attract attention from both sides. You become a beacon in the dark. If your own psychology isn't grounded and balanced, that much light can literally burn out your circuits.
Let's try to lighten the mood a bit, because alongside the heavy philosophy, Ra also solves some fun historical mysteries. The Great Pyramid of Giza. All our history books say armies of slaves built it with ropes and ramps. Ra says, no, we did.
We built it with thought. That's their claim. Ra says they used their deep understanding of the Law of One to directly manipulate the intelligent energy of the stone itself. They call it everlasting rock. They simply visualized the pyramid in its completed form, and the rock conformed to that mental blueprint.
And it wasn't a tomb for a dead pharaoh, like Egyptologists claim.
No, absolutely not. It was a machine, a metaphysical machine for initiation. Ray explains that the specific, precise, geometric shape of the pyramid acts as a funnel to gather and focus cosmic energy. The King's Chamber, right in the center, is the ultimate resonance point.
What actually happens in that chamber?
Initiation. A prepared student would lie down in the stone sarcophagus. The intense sensory deprivation, combined with the incredibly focused cosmic energy pouring in, would force a complete dissociation of the mind from the physical body. It was basically designed to force the soul to cross the threshold of death, experience the reality of the Creator, and then return to the body with that absolute knowledge.
It was shock therapy for spiritual enlightenment.
Essentially, yes. But, as we said earlier, as the civilization devolved, the later Egyptians completely forgot the true purpose. They started using these sacred machines for royal burials, which completely corrupted the vibration and broke the machine.
One thing I felt we missed in our earlier outline was the tarot. Ra spends a truly massive amount of time in the later sessions talking about the tarot cards. Why? Because honestly, to a skeptic, it feels so fortune-tellery. It feels out of place with the quantum physics.
I thought the exact same thing when I first read it. I almost skipped those chapters. But Ra isn't using the tarot for fortune telling or predicting the future. They use it as a visual textbook for what they call the archetypical mind.
What is the archetypical mind?
It's the foundational blueprint of human consciousness. Ra says the human mind is structured by the logos in a very specific universal way. To help Don understand how we spiritually evolve, they use the major arcana of the tarot, specifically the Egyptian origins of it, as a visual language. They meticulously group the cards into cycles of the mind, the body, and the spirit.
And they break them down into specific stages, right? The matrix, the potentiator.
Right. It's highly structured. Take the mind cycle, for example. You have the matrix of the mind, which is represented by card one, the magician. That's the conscious mind, the active principle, the part of you that reaches out into the world. Then you have the potentiator of the mind, which is card two, the high priestess. That's the vast unconscious, the deep, dark ocean of potential.
So the active conscious mind reaches into the passive unconscious.
Exactly. Yeah. And the result of that interaction is the significator, the self. Ra goes through almost every major card, the Emperor, the Hierophant, the Lovers, and thoroughly explains how they represent very specific, necessary stages of psychological and spiritual processing. It completely turns the tarot from a cheap parlor trick into a rigorous psychological map of evolution. It's the hero's journey. Totally systematized.
I've covered a massive amount of ground today. We've gone from exploding planets to telepathic group minds, from the tragedy of suicide to pyramids built by thought. But I want to bring it all the way back down to the listener, to the person driving their car, doing the dishes, or walking their dog right now.
The ultimate so what factor.
Exactly. If this is all actually true, if we truly are all one, if we are here behind a veil specifically to make a choice, what do we do with that information on a Tuesday morning? Do we need to go to Egypt and sleep in a pyramid? Do we need to move to a cabin in the woods and meditate for 10 hours a day?
Ra is remarkably clear on this point. You do not need to go anywhere. You don't need a guru. The work is entirely internal. It all comes down to how you handle what they call the catalyst.
Catalyst being just everything that happens to us.
Everything. The rude waiter at the restaurant, the flat tire on the way to work, the painful divorce, the unexpected promotion. Ra views absolutely every single event that happens to you, good or bad, as catalyst. It is raw fuel for your spiritual fire.
So when something terrible happens, instead of reacting as a victim and saying, why is this happening to me? Right, the law of one asks a different question.
It asks, how can I use this to polarize? If you react to the flat tire with intense anger, blaming others, and a desire to lash out, you are using that catalyst to create separation. You are actively polarizing towards service to self.
And if you react differently, with patience.
If you can stop, look at the rude waiter who just messed up your order, and deeply realize, he is me. He is the creator having a very stressful day, and you manage to offer him genuine patience or forgiveness. You have just used that catalyst to polarize towards service to others. You have literally radiated light into the planetary grid.
It makes every single mundane moment of the day a massive spiritual opportunity. You don't have to be a monk in a cave. You just have to be aware.
That's it entirely. Awareness. Yeah. Ra does suggest meditation, even just a few minutes a day, to help quiet the noise and find that internal silence where the unity actually lives. But the real heavy lifting practice is out in the marketplace. It's in your daily interactions with your family, your coworkers, and strangers.
And I think that's exactly why this incredibly weird, difficult material has endured for over 40 years. It doesn't ask you to join a cult. It doesn't ask for your money. It doesn't ask you to believe in a punishing God. It just hands you this incredibly complex cosmic map and says, you're the driver. Where do you want to go?
It completely respects your free will above all else.
We're going to wrap up with the traditional sign-off that Ra used at the end of every single session. It feels like the only appropriate way to close out a deep dive like this.
I leave you, my friends, in the love and the light of the one infinite creator. Go forth then, rejoicing in the power and the peace of the one creator, Adonai.
Adonai. And to you listening, I want to leave you with one final thought. What if the very thing frustrating you the most today, the difficult person, the bad job, the physical pain, what if that was specifically designed by you before you were even born, just to test your polarity? Look at your life today. Are you building walls or are you building bridges? The choice, as always, is entirely yours. Thanks for diving deep with us.